Good evening. This is Mark Lynch, and this is Inquiry. My guest tonight is journalist Cassidy Randall. She writes about the environment, adventure, and people who expand human potential. And we're talking about her new book, 30 Below, the harrowing and heroic story of the first all-women's ascent of Denali. Cassidy, welcome to the show. It's a real pleasure to talk about this book.
Thank you so much for having me.
Now, I've never used this term in like 30 years of doing this show when I'm talking to an author, but this really was a gripping story. It was just brutal and crazy. How did you create a cohesive narrative about the ascent?
Oh, that's such a good question, because I have a binder that's probably 6 inches thick, just of correspondence between all these women, right? And between other people. So it was a feat for sure. So it was a lot of putting together their letters back and forth. I love that even though, you know, they were planning in 1969 and 1970, they didn't really seem to use phones. They wrote to each other.
I know, that was weird. I know, that was so strange to read. But that's what people did then.
I know, and you say it makes you think about what would it be like if somebody tried to write something about us in the future now. I mean, all of our correspondence is over email that nobody keeps, or text. It wouldn't be as fun, that's for sure.
And the story of the ascent, and I want to say for the benefit of the audience, that I'm going to sort of avoid details about that, because the story, you have to read it, because you really actually, after a while, I feel like you're on the slope there, and God, it's insane. But the six women are Grace Hohmann, Arlene Blum, or Bloom,
Bloom,
Margaret Clark, Faye Kerr, Dana Isherwood, Margaret Young, who you, because there's two Margarets, you end up abbreviating MY, are the six women that ascend Denali. Now, before we talk about Denali as a mountaineering problem, let's talk about 1970, which is when this occurs. What's the state of women in mountaineering at that time?
Also a great question.
And that's a major theme of your book, because it just comes out all over the place.
It does, I know. And it's funny, because before I get to that question about what the state of mountaineering was like, I just want to say that although this book, I mean, there's a lot of gender lens in it, because that's just what these women were facing down, right? It just was the landscape they were in. I don't necessarily want it to be viewed as just a book about women. It's just a great adventure story,
oh, yeah.
Right? The way that ends with an air.
Oh, yeah. Once they get on. Yeah. But you can't avoid the fact of what was going on with women in mountaineering at the time. It was insane. It was just ridiculous. But talk about it.
Yeah. So there was, even as late as 1970, and for context here, we had sent men to the moon by 1970, and women hadn't stood on the highest points on Earth, which is wild. Like, this isn't that long ago, right? It's really, like, modern history when we think about it. But so popular belief at the time was that women, without men's help, were incapable of withstanding high altitudes, you know, these savage elements, carrying heavy loads up storm-ravaged slopes day after day. And, of course, everyone assumed that their periods made them weaker and prone to hysteria.
Wow, there was so much focus on a woman's period. What would happen, God forbid?
Right? I mean, I actually note that in my book at one point. Can you imagine if it would be acknowledged that women could achieve the same summit as men while in pain and on this hormonal roller coaster? I mean, what a powerful threat to the very foundations of the weaker narrative, sex, the weaker sex narrative itself.
Well,
that is just.
They were concerned that how would women pee?
Okay, so let's get into, there are a couple of just outrageous anecdotes in the book leading up to what made this such an audacious idea at the time, that women would climb by themselves to the summit of one of the world's big peaks. And one of them, Arlene, had been barred from expeditions, one of them to Afghanistan, because the trip leader told her that the presence of women would be unpleasant in excretory situations. So that's one. And then, I mean, another outrageous one is just 9 years before these women attempt Denali in 1961. Irene Miller, this really accomplished American climber, went to Makalu Base Camp in the Himalaya with her husband, hoping to join Sir Edmund Hillary's expedition up that mountain. Hillary not only forbade her from the expedition, one of the members of his team said that if she wanted to join the expedition, she ought to be willing to sleep with all the men on the team, as in have sex with, despite the fact she had gone to base camp with her husband. So that's sort of
When I read that, I was shocked. I mean, I knew that there was sexism, but that statement was just awful.
And it's just laughable, right?
It's more than laughable. It's like, that's like serious craziness. Amazing thing is they couldn't even join mountaineering clubs.
Right. Yeah. So Arlene actually chose MIT over Harvard as she was going for a master's in chemistry, a PhD in chemistry. And she did that because Harvard, at the time, I mean, women weren't even allowed in the library stacks at Harvard until 1968, I think. I can't remember the exact date, but that the outing club there, the mountaineering club at Harvard, still didn't allow women in, and MIT did.
Jeez. It's amazing. Now, as you bring out in the book, women had been mountaineering nonetheless for some time. There were people like Fanny Bullock Workman and Elizabeth LeBlanc. Most of them were just sort of, screw it, I'm going to do it anyway.
They were, and that didn't mean it was easy for them. I love learning about Elizabeth LeBlanc was climbing around the turn of the 20th century. She was an Irish alpinist, and she would go mountaineering in the Alps and just scandalize prim Victorian society in Europe, right? Because she went without a husband, and it was very unseemly for women at that time to spend a night out without chaperone of a male family member, right? And she would go with her guides. But I also love, this one is so indicative of what women were facing. So at the time, women were expected to climb in skirts, which is ridiculous. I mean, imagine these heavy pieces of fabric just covering your legs. They're wet with snow. It just seems awful. And so Elizabeth LeBlanc would shuck her skirt once she was out of sight of huts or towns and just climb in her bloomers. And once she came back to find an avalanche had swept away her skirt, and she had to wait in town behind a tree while her guide went to find her something to wear from her suitcase in her hotel. And he came back carrying an evening gown. So, I mean, that's a, Elizabeth LeBlanc would do it anyway. Fanny Bullock Workman was climbing with her husband. There were other women who had attempted some all-female ascents before this 1970 try, but should be said that they were climbing with male guides and male Sherpas. They didn't try to do it all on their own, but one of those in 1959 was Claude Kogan, and she was going up Cho Oyu in the Himalaya, which is the world's sixth highest peak. And this one is actually a really sad example of what women were facing at the time, that an avalanche swept away Kogan, two of her expedition mates, and a couple of the Sherpas at their high camp before they reached the summit and killed them. And a British reporter named Stephen Harper called it yet another verdict that women are still the weaker sex in the white hell of an avalanche-torn mountain, right? So it's just, for women at the time, it was either, you know, success was wrenched from the hands of men or failure was not an option.
One of the things I want to talk about, and you write about it in different places in the book, is 1970. So what was the state of equipment and clothes versus today?
Oh, I love this, especially because you think about the fact that people were still climbing mountains at that point, siege style, which means that very different from the light and fast alpinism of today, where they would carry just hundreds of pounds of supplies on their backs and leapfrog them up a mountain to establish stocked camps all the way up. And so you're carrying just like so much food. And on Denali, there are these photos of this women's team in 1970 doing this with the snowshoes of the time that are like,
oh, there were these huge snowshoes. Oh God.
Yeah.
So even things like the parkas, you know, they were old style parkas. I mean, every piece of equipment, every piece of clothing is very old style.
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, performance wear wasn't quite a thing yet, you know, like we're still in the very early days of Yvon Chouinard trying to make mountaineering gear in his own garage because there was nothing for it. Right. I mean, people made a lot of their own gear at the time still.
Now, let's talk about Denali as a climb, generally. For people who don't know, can we start from the very beginning and talk about Denali as a mountain?
Yes. So Denali, which, side note, that at the time that I wrote this book, it was still called Denali. And so, you know, Denali is the name that the mountain has held for millennia, and it is Athabascan, Koyukon Athabascan for the Great One. And it was called that in every language of all of the different Athabascan people who live near the mountain. Its name was similar. It was the Tall One, the High One, the Great One. And so as the biggest mountain in North America, the tallest mountain, it scrapes the sky at over 20,000 feet, and all the peaks surrounding it are, you know, 17,000 feet. And by, you know, in 1970, most of those lesser peaks had never been climbed. People had no idea what was in there, really. And Denali itself, as it's the tallest peak in North America, not the tallest peak in the world. It's not nearly as tall as the 7,000 and 8,000 meter peaks in the Himalaya, but it is the biggest, one of the biggest mountains. So it rises because it sits really low on the tundra. It rises 18,000 feet from its base, which is a full 6,000 feet more than Everest rises from its base. And that immense altitude gain means that climbers have to be on the mountain for so much longer to acclimatize. And that subjects them to this wild weather that hits Denali because it's the highest polar mountain sitting so far north and close to the coast. It just gets this savage, unpredictable weather. Even today, the weather is still really hard to predict on Denali. High winds, just incredibly cold all the time. In 1967, there was this, it's still the worst tragedy to ever occur on the mountain. And the 1970 climb leader, Grace Holman, was on the mountain in 1967 when this insane storm hit the top of Denali, and winds were estimated at 300 miles an hour. And that's not
a typo. I thought that was a typo. I thought that was a typo when I read that.
I know.
Oh, my God.
Yeah. So it's not the tallest mountain. It's not the most technical, but it is infamous as one of the fiercest to climb.
And you're climbing over glaciers. There's always a chance that you're going to fall into a crevasse. I mean, the list just goes on about what a taxing climb this is. It's amazing for everybody.
Yeah. So most expeditions at that point plan to be on the mountain for a month, which is a long time. Yeah. And yeah, you're navigating crevasses, whiteout conditions, serious exposure where unprotected falls could mean, you know, you're slipping more than 1,000 feet with nothing to catch you. So, and of course, there's the thin air, so it might not be as high as those high mountains in the Himalaya with that thin air, but because of where it sits, high on the 63rd parallel, that makes its air thin. So the top of Denali is really similar to the heights of those high Himalaya mountains in terms of oxygen levels.
You're listening to WISN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name is Mark Lynch. My guest tonight is journalist Cassidy Randall. She writes about the environment, adventure, and people who expand human potential. And we're talking about her new book, 30 Below, the harrowing and heroic story of the first all-women's ascent of Denali. Your book is also a peek into what happens on a climb when there's a bunch of participants and that the tensions are aggravated by altitude. I mean, and all the weather. I mean, the social situation on a climb like this is very complex and often deteriorates.
Yeah, so one of the effects of altitude, and altitude has a couple of different sort of effects on people. It can, in some cases, induce euphoria, right? Like hilarious laughter and incredible happiness. In most cases, though, it makes you really irritable when you're not getting enough oxygen to your brain, to your blood. You're tired, you're nauseous, your appetite's gone. And what that does is just slay you raw and kind of down to your most foundational self, right? And sort of how I think how we decide to act in those situations. maybe is really indicative of who we are, but it's also a huge personal challenge, right? A lot of people want to rise to that and think we can still treat each other really well under those circumstances. But what I was really privileged with in writing this book was that there are four surviving journals from the expedition members. And these were not kind of typical mountaineering journals that just record the weather and what the route was and gear and what to bring next time. These were internal journeys. And so you could really see into the heads of the women who were on this climb, which is, I mean, really exceptional. And so what's really interesting in putting together a whole narrative then is that you have these subjective takes on events. And that's a really, really cool way to bring some, I think, heart into, I think typical exploration and mountaineering books often in the past have been a little bit dry. They're not as much, they aren't imbued with the heart and emotion that you want from something like this. And a lot of that is because the people who were on those expeditions just didn't write that, right? So we don't have that kind of record. But so it's amazing to be able to have that.
All the things that are going on that you wrote about and you're talking about now, people are also jammed into tiny spaces, and you're usually very, very cold all the time. It's amazing. There's like a cave that they keep jamming into. And I mean, really jamming into, or if you have a tent, it's like a bunch of you are in the small tent. So everything that you talked about, the effects of altitude, is exasperated by the fact that you're like cheek to jowl with all the other people on the team.
Oh, yeah. There's just like alone time is a myth, right? On an expedition like that. Excuse me. I just needed to cough there for a second. Alone time is a myth on an expedition like this. You're sharing tents, and your tents are full of gear that you're trying to dry, right? Because it's probably snowing outside, or it's just been sweating on it, or whatever. You're constantly melting water to get enough water. You're melting snow into water. You are dealing with, you know, stamping down a tent platform in the snow before you can even erect it. You're digging out snow blocks to create walls around your tent because there's so much wind. You're tired. I mean, and when you have a rest day, you get to, you know, write or read or just talk to each other, but you don't get to be alone. Like, the only time you're really alone is when you're roped up so that you don't fall into if you fall into a crevasse that's been hidden, somebody can pull you out. That's your only alone time, when you're 30 feet behind somebody on a rope when you're climbing.
Each one of these women have a tremendous backstory before they joined the Denali Damsels, as the team was called. Each one of those stories are just as riveting and just as fascinating. Let's talk about Grace. She's the oldest member of the team. She lost her beloved husband, Vin, just a couple of years before this climb.
She did. So I think that Grace is just so incredibly fascinating. I could have written a whole book.
Yeah, absolutely.
And the stakes that she carried up the Denali were so varied and complicated and heavy. But I just want to give a snapshot of who Grace was. So at the time that she led the climb, she was 41. But before that, so she was raised in Holland, and she went to university for a medical degree. She wanted to be a surgeon in Berlin in 1942, in the heart of World War II, because it was the best university. She knew that that's where she wanted to be, regardless of the fact that it was the Third Reich. And by the time she was 21, she had fallen in love with a fellow doctor, married him, they'd had a child, and then she was widowed when he was shot in combat while she was pregnant with their second child. So she finishes out her medical degree, 21 years old, has a 2-year-old, is pregnant, she's single parenting, finishes out her medical degree. Her mother hops on a bike from Holland, finds a bike for Grace, and the two women cycle their tiny little girls out of wartime Germany. I mean, this is who Grace is. It's just so amazing. And so by the time, you know, 22 years later, she ends up in Alaska and falls back in love with mountaineering. She's been introduced to it in Europe. She also falls in love with the man who becomes her third husband, whose name is Vin Holman, and he is this just accomplished mountaineer, really well known. And there's this heartbreaking story where he was invited to go to Dalagiri 1 in the Himalaya, and the team leader for that expedition asked Vin to help find other accomplished members to do that climb. It was an incredibly difficult climb. And then Pitts puts Grace forward. And Grace was a doctor, which is incredibly helpful on these expeditions, right? And she had a ton of experience. She had done solo first ascent. She climbed all over the world. And the leader of that expedition turns her down. He says that she's suffering from illusions of grandeur and she has light experience. And what ends up happening is that Vin never comes home from the Himalayas. He dies in an avalanche on Dalagiri 1. And Grace ends up with this just insane survivor's guilt, thinking, if I had been there, I would have made different choices and he would not have been in that place. He would have survived. And that is one of the things that spurs her to lead an all-female ascent up Denali, because she wonders, would women be safer to have around? And we just need to prove that we belong in these mountains, so I could have been on that expedition.
So how did she organize? How did she get the team together?
There's this great, fateful path that leads her and Arlene Bloom together. And it has to do with Vin dying, and I don't want to give away too much in the book. But so they basically find each other, and they're kindred souls in the fact that Arlene, remember, had also been barred from expeditions, big expeditions, and just been told some of the most outrageous things. Like, one male guide told her that women either aren't good climbers or aren't real women. So she just was, you know, had her own stakes too. She wanted to prove that it was possible that women could do this. And so Arlene and Grace find each other. Grace tells Arlene, hey, I'm thinking about doing this all-women's climb up Denali. If we can find enough women, are you interested? And Arlene becomes deputy leader. And together, the two women put together, also all of them through very fateful paths for the most part, this team of women that's made up of three Californians, including Arlene. It was from Berkeley at the time. Grace, who's in Alaska, Margaret Clark, who's a New Zealander, and Faye Kerr, who's an Australian. And the two Commonwealthers, Margaret Clark and Faye, had kind of known each other, but they also were in entirely different parts of the world at the time this climb was being put together, and were invited through totally separate avenues. So the whole thing is just is so as if it was serendipitous that these women came together.
And the raison d'etre for this climb is that it's an all-women's climb. Therefore, there's not going to be any men carrying material or anything like that. There's not going to be a male guide.
Exactly. Yep. And that, again, had never been done. And the thing, I know that they did not realize at the time that they were the first all-women's attempt in history to try this without male guides, without, you know, porters. And part of that was that, you know, women's mountaineering was so obscure that most people didn't know who anyone else really was at the time. And some, you know, Arlene knew who a few big name female climbers had been, but not all of them. And what was wild was how even the women on this climb didn't know if it was going to be possible. Like, it's amazing that they stepped forward to try this thing that literally everyone thought was impossible.
And before they even did the climb, like, a whole set of things happened to these different women. Like, one was diagnosed with multiple sclerosis. One had a corkscrew fracture of the tibia. One was hit by falling rocks. I mean, the list goes on. So in just a couple of years, just before this, all these events happened to these women, yet it still occurred.
Yeah, I mean, it was even in like the 6 months leading up to the climb that these things were happening. That, I mean, yeah, Margaret Young fell 900 feet down Mount Tyndall in the Sierra. Arlene broke her leg in a ski accident. That doctor.
And it was a corkscrew fracture. They didn't think she was going to walk for like months.
Yeah, I mean, you can't even for a year, her doctor thought. But her recovery was nothing short of miraculous. And so it really was like all of these obstacles just throwing themselves in the way, that it feels also just miraculous that they even made it to the base of Denali.
Now, I have to admit, the story I was most interested in is Margaret Young, because that was wild.
What an eccentric. Yes.
We're not going to have time to really go into it in detail. She was a physicist and a pilot. She worked on nuclear reactor designs. But her personal life was really fascinating. And it really, even on the climb, she would do things while everybody was doing something. All of a sudden, at one point, as they were descending, she sort of walked off. And people were going like, do you know where she's going? But that's the way she was. She was very independent and very into what she, you know, what her idea of what was going on. Not very communicative.
No, she strikes me as a kind of a typical genius personality with weird social skills and just did not care what anyone thought of her.
I think one of my favorite stories is that when a guy wanted to sleep with her, she would get him in a plane and fly him to Las Vegas and fix him up with a hooker.
Yes. That's what her son told me, that she was known to do that when men were, that she didn't want to be interested in her. She would just drop them in Vegas in her Cessna.
She was amazing. Now, I have to ask you this question, because when I've been telling people about this book, when I'm telling about everything that's going on, they want to know, why do people do this? Like, why is this fun? Why is this something that people want to do? And I know I don't have a lot of time left, but you should just address that.
Yes, I love that question. So there's so many reasons. I mean, one, adrenaline can be this quicksilver flash that's just, you know, very addictive. So can endorphins, right? Which is more what we get when we're
so do you climb? Do you climb?
I am not an alpinist. I'm a backcountry skier, and I dabble in ski mountaineering.
Okay, we're going to, unfortunately, Cassidy, we're going to have to leave there because we're running out of time. But I hope we've whet people's appetites for this book. My guest tonight has been journalist Cassidy Randall. She writes about the environment, adventure, and people who expand human potential. And we're talking about her new book, 30 Below, the harrowing and heroic story of the first all-women's ascent of the Denali. Trust me, you have no idea how the story is going to end, because I didn't. Cassie, it's been a real pleasure.
Thank you so much.
You're listening to WICN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name is Mark Lynch. Good night.